So today is Thursday, April 18th, 2019. I'm Leslie McCartney, and we're back in the National Park Service office in Nome with Jeanette and Katie to pick up where we left off yesterday. And Jeanette, we were talking yesterday about adaptations and changes in landscape and how to minimize and protect resources from those damages. We talked a little bit about the beavers coming up and changing the wetlands and grassland environment that way, permafrost thawing in the vegetation. And then we talked about allodi perhaps in water when we were talking about invasive species coming up. And so we just wanted to sort of branch out from there, talking about more environmental changes that you've seen or that you know that the park or natural preserve is experiencing. So what comes to mind other than those two things when we're talking about changes that you have heard or witnessed about in the last 20 years in the Bering Land Bridge National Preserve?
I think definitely the difference in freeze and thaw seasons. I think people talk about that a lot as far as... For example, when I was a kid growing up here, winter was in September. By the time you went out to do moose hunt, there was usually a hard ground and some snow.
And when would you go out for moose hunt?
In the fall, in September.
In September.
But now, at least from personal experience and discussions with others, it's not frozen, the ground's not frozen, there's usually not snow, and it's usually raining, where normally you would have had more snow. And when I was a kid, I must have, beginning at the age of 12, which was in 1984, it was colder. And then we would snow, and it would be cold until about June. When I remember finishing school at the end of May, and there still be snow patches all over, and having prom and wearing a actual jacket and boots to prom, and then having to change. But now in May, there's less snow, and people are. Transitioning to spring when that wouldn't have happened until at least almost a month later.
And do you find it in, now it's more October then, where the...
October, November, sometimes even December. And we definitely don't get really good frozen ice for ice fishing or in the ocean until at least January now. Mm-hmm. So I remember the ice being out in November and December because we used to go down... and tomcod fish at Nook, which is about, 30 miles on the coast. Mm-hmm. But now we go later to do that. If you're lucky, if we've had a good freeze up, you can go, like in December. But I remember, I feel like it was October when we were kids. And then definitely I remember always having to wear full gear to go Halloween trick-or-treating. I mean, we had to wear snowsuit, everything. I remember my face getting painted and it feeling like it was frozen. And now I send my kids out with a light jacket and rubber boots.
Right.
So that's a huge, huge difference. And sometimes it's raining at the end of October.
Hmm.
I feel like and people might say, oh, a month or two, that's not too bad. But for a place where people are used to doing things at certain times of the year, where we're dependent on life cycles of animals for hunting and their own, calving, or when a moose is in rut, we don't kill certain animals when their life cycle has different things, right? And they have the same rut. They have the same calving. They have the same pregnancy. But the time that and the seasons that we go out are changing to be able to do those activities. So it really impacts, the weather really impacts and the climate when we can go out to do those activities.
Mm-hmm.
If it greens up to in May, I mean, then you're going out and you're collecting greens a lot earlier than we used to in June.
Mm-hmm.
The berries seem to be off a little bit, a couple weeks, but berries seem to have been a little bit more consistent to me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe because I don't pay all that much attention to berries. When they come out, but I do feel like they haven't changed that much. Someone might, who really pays attention to berries, might say something different.
Right.
Definitely hunting is different.
So, hunting's different. So you were saying yesterday that a lot of the people from Shishmaref use the National Preserve mm-hmm. for subsistence. So are you hearing the same things from them?
Yes, they worry about not being able, if their inlet doesn't freeze, because they're on a little island, they can't cross it by snowmobile. And there's no way to cross by boat and then do what, walk on the tundra? I mean, there's just no way for them to access during times of the year that they normally wouldn't if that inlet's not freezing. And there's no way to get anywhere if the ground's not frozen and there's no snow. So even if there are plentiful moose or caribou or muskox, they can't get to them. And it's the same is true for the ice, too. And the way walrus and seals are dependent on the ice floes. If there's no ice, there are no animals
right.
for them to go and hunt.
Yeah.
Or they have to go way far out, which endangers them, because the ocean is, it with the lack of emergency response, it can be a dangerous place. So where you used to go out just a mile, people are going out 5 miles, 10 miles, farther to get to the marine mammals that they would have normally gotten closer to home.
Right. So not only dangerous, but more expensive.
Yes. Yes. And then if you ever hunt subsistence or anything in our region, you know how people know how expensive it is to go and not get anything.
Right.
And so while the activity is fun and enjoyable, to come home empty-handed is really a shame. When you would normally know where to go, you would normally know if it was a good hunting spot in the past, how many animals might be there. If all that's changing, you have to adapt, but it's also really concerning. And I do think people are suffering from that unknown. But also they have a lament to, when I discuss things with them about these rapid changes to their environment, it makes them sad.
Mm.
And they can't do anything to make it stop or so it gives you this feeling of, you know, like helplessness, but they also know that they're adapting.
What are some of the adaptations then that people are making?
They're asking for different hunting seasons, for seasons to stay open longer or be open sooner so they can go by boat. It's hard because, like I said, the biological animal issues make it hard, too, because you don't want to hunt pregnant caribou. I mean, moose in rut, or how do you hunt moose when their antlers have fallen off and you can't tell a male from a female mm-hmm. sometimes? So that's the other thing. So people are asking for different windows of opportunity. I think that people are trying to be safe by purchasing expensive technology like spots and inreaches to help. I think...
Is there any federal assistance for purchasing something like that?
I don't know. No. I don't know. I think their search and rescue folks are trying to get more money for those off seasons that people aren't used to. Mm-hmm. The fact that people are falling through the ice, yeah, because normally that would be frozen, and we've had deaths already this year here and up in the Kotzebue area, mm-hmm, from people in falling through the ice. And then they've had search and rescues, of course, in the Bethel area earlier, yeah, on than we have. I think people are trying their best to prepare for the changes. Everybody longs for what was good in the past. And I think for local people, it's particularly sad that these things can't be changed by them, that they can't influence climate change at a local level because they're not the ones that are having a big influence on that type of...
So in a community where sharing is a large part of the distribution of food, have you seen any changes in that when people bring back... caribou or moose? Is there still large sharing?
I think, yes, everybody shares, and I think they give to elders. I think they help people who can't hunt still. I think there's still a lot of that going on because everybody considers everybody family in a way. So I think one thing that would help, and they talk about this, is how to get goods and services that aren't so expensive that supplement subsistence foods at the store, mm-hmm, so that they're not spending so much if they need to buy something at the store. The problem is the cost of goods and services, because transportation costs are so high, really inhibit healthy foods or other foods purchased when they can't get more healthy subsistence foods. And that needs to be discussed too. How do you work through that also so people can eat nutritiously and afford it, mm-hmm, when their environment is changing, where they're having a hard time getting the more healthy, nutritious foods from the land? I think that conversation for food security in both ways, I think people are working toward that discussion.
So it's currently being ongoing discussion then,
yes,
is it? It has been entered into. Yes,
because if you've ever been to a village, even Teller, that's on the road system, you know that, Nome is double the price of Anchorage. Teller is almost double the price of Nome. And how people can afford that,
right?
I don't know. Yeah. But it's a lot of probably buying cheaper pre-made foods rather than healthier fruits and vegetables,
right,
because of that cost.
Yeah, right. You had mentioned that you first started going out to the preserve in 1994 as a
park ranger.
Park ranger, yeah. Have you been going back to the same places over the years at all? Or because you're superintendent, you're more based now in Nome?
Because I'm a superintendent, I don't get to go anywhere.
Oh.
But the thing is I do go to a lot of village meetings and community meetings, but we only have so much budget. So in my mind, it really helps to get the interpreters out, biologists, all the people that need to advise me. I would love to have the funding to go out, but a lot of times I try to save that for staff. And I trust their knowledge to tell me what they're seeing and what people are saying. And And then making management decision on that. But it would be really nice to be able to afford to go to some of these places and see if they've changed.
That was going to be my question. Or, yeah. After, you know, what did it look like then?
Yeah, or to see, you do get to go to Serpentine every once in a while, even though that's even been a couple years. And I've seen changes there from when I used to go in the 90s.
So what did it look like in the 90s, and then what have you witnessed as changing today?
The big changes today are, before the beavers, was we're getting taller willow growth and shrubs, and we've had to cut back the airstrip in particular for more willow growth. And then when I was there in the early 90s, there weren't alders or cottonwood trees growing on the banks, and they weren't as tall as they were. Now those are gone. I mean, I think they'll grow back because, you know, those all have really unique root systems.
How are they gone? What were
they?
Beavers just took
them out.
Right? From 1 year to the next.
Really? Just, they were gone. One year they were there, and now they're gone. The beavers just took them out. And the other thing is the hydrology. Mm-hmm. The hydrology of that valley, that valley has changed and is different.
And due to the beavers.
Due to the beavers.
Yeah.
And I think beavers are I don't know if biologists will agree with me, but I do think beavers are a product of climate change. They need bigger wood, more wood to survive. And when you had a really strict tundra environment, they didn't have that. But now, as the environment's changing, you know, trees, willows are supporting that change.
It's their food source.
It is. And so now they've got food source. And as that changes going farther north, and beavers can change an environment really quickly. I mean, they are environmental changers. Or maybe not environment, landscape changers. As, you know, they create lakes. They dam up rivers. And so that's something I think that people are going to have to pay more attention to is... Mm-hmm. is how beavers are affecting that landscape. And we're definitely, the Park Service is definitely going to have to learn to manage Serpentine for that change. We never talked about a beaver management plan or a hydrology plan until just like 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. We started going, oh my gosh, we can either let beavers manage Serpentine and lose the hot spring, or we can start thinking of how do we do this, and starting small, like when I was talking about a possible beaver trapping clinic so that local people can start trapping mm-hmm. beaver and utilizing them for subsistence food and teaching them, that is a kind of a small way that we thought would be a great start to that. And then having a dry hydrologist go out there and say, if you take out that dam, it's going to take out all this. Mm-hmm. So how do you do that in a way that doesn't damage the hot spring pool itself or the facilities that are there? Right. It's going to be a challenge for us because we were used to it being a certain way for a really, really long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have a hydrologist on staff then?
There's one in the regional office.
Okay.
And he'll come from Anchorage.
So interestingly enough, and we've spoken to especially Taze, he was saying that because the permafrost is thawing, a lot of the small shallow lakes are also draining and going away and becoming now grasslands and dry. So have you noticed the same thing more inland?
Yes, and they've taken, well, mostly out into from the coast out. Mm-hmm. But they take a lot of photos of those, and they'll show them be gone. Yeah, it's the permafrost thawing, and the water just dissipates into the tundra.
Right, and then it becomes very dry.
Yeah, and then it's grassland.
Right.
In a way, the grassland that is described during 10,000 years ago through the Ice Age is like possibly little mini grasslands
kind of
in that thought.
Tundra step.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
On a large scale, I have no idea what that's going to look like.
The woolly mammoth will roam again.
We brought the muskox back. I mean, you never know. Well, they didn't go extinct. They were just extinct in our region, but then, you know, they were reintroduced.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we didn't have to genetically engineer muskox.
So with the season, the winter season being shorter, have you noticed or any of your staff noticed the migrations of birds changing? The types of birds or the timing?
I haven't thought of that. And that isn't one of the things that we've asked local people, although I'm sure they might. The migratory bird person that works with the Migratory Bird Council is at Quarick. And I think that's Austin Amasuk, but I'm not sure.
I think we tried to interview, is that Austin that we tried to?
Yeah.
Yes, he's out of town right now.
Yeah. That could be him. That would be an interesting question for local folks. Because they not only hunt birds, but they also collect eggs.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
There have been, through the Leo network that Jacob had mentioned as well, there have been a few different reports from what I've seen about some birds that have been, they've just been kind of hanging out for the whole winter, and so kind of differences in things happening, not necessarily right here, but throughout the Arctic.
Right.
Interesting. That is interesting. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we've been really concerned about the muir die-off, large die-offs. And I think the biologists are contributing to that, to starvation with ocean temperature change. The fish that they eat are swimming farther down, and they're having deeper in the ocean, and the birds are having a hard time getting those fish, and they're dying off the coast and then washing up on shore.
So these fish must like cold water then, and the upper water is warming, and so they're going deeper.
And they NOAA did say that the Bering Sea warmed, I think last summer in some spots by 4 degrees, which is enough to change migration patterns and for fish and mammals, mm-hmm. even marine mammals.
Yeah.
So birds are, from the carcasses they've collected, I believe our biologist, Stasia Beckenstowe, that works on this project, believes that it's from starvation.
Have you had a lot of sea mammals, too, washing up on the shores?
Not many more than normal, no. But a good person to ask would be Gay Sheffield.
Yes, we've been trying to contact
Gay. About Gay, and then Gay is a good person. She also knows about the bird die-off, which, unfortunately, I think we're going to expect more of those in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Because those ecosystems are highly dependent on temperature mm-hmm. of the water.
Yeah. Any other major changes, then, that we haven't discussed at all, Jeanette?
I think that's it. I mean, I think that we talk about the environment a lot with animals and stuff, but I can't downplay the significance to the local Indigenous people and how it affects them at an everyday level, as far as erosion, the foods they eat, the times they hunt, the times they utilize the preserve for subsistence and recreation, and also going from village to village travel and getting to their own camping areas. I really feel like it impacts them daily.
So that brings me to a bigger, more global question, is how do we make others aware of this and make it important to them?
I think through education, I feel that there should be a larger coordinated effort. I think we piecemeal things into different agencies. There was an initiative through Fish and Wildlife Service called Landscape Conservation Cooperatives that was funded through the Obama administration. Those were unfunded. And they were an excellent forum for federal land managers and tribal people to get together and discuss these issues and create partnerships. And you might say, oh, why can't we just do that on our own? But this supplied one staff person that would organize monthly meetings. Mm-hmm. I know that sounds like, oh, that can't be that hard.
Oh, yes, it is. In the communities, no. Yes.
Yeah, and they sent notices out. They took the minutes. They had one annual in-person meeting. They created landscape strategies with everybody. Even some landscape conservation cooperatives had project funding you could apply for. To help get data or create educational materials and solutions. And even at a DOI level, that was excellent. And now we're struggling to continue that effort without staffing throughout these landscape conservation cooperatives. Some have just disappeared. Others, like in the state of Alaska, are being funded through grant funding through agencies like the Alaska Conservation Association. I think through the efforts of many, I think we would do better, and we wouldn't be duplicating things that others are doing if there was at least that forum for cooperation and coordination and time for people to talk about their projects and what they're doing. I think it also provided tribal input in an equal playing field with the federal agencies. So I really enjoyed that coordinated effort and that funding for these landscape conservation cooperatives. But unfortunately, now they no longer exist at the same level.
Right. Katie, you had a couple of questions I know that you wanted to ask Jeanette.
Yeah, kind of as an extension of what we were just talking about, I was curious to hear your thoughts on, like, if you were in... having a chat with youth in New Hampshire, for example, what message would you want them to take home regarding kind of two things, like changes that you've observed and actions that they could take to help out? Because, you know, like in New Hampshire, the impacts are being experienced not necessarily on a daily basis like up here and in a different, very different manner and way. So yeah, what message would you want to share with them?
I think my message would be is to think globally. I feel like we're in an age now where we're very nationalized, but thinking globally allows people to empathize but also make larger changes to their environment. Even in Alaska, I think I would say that to local students. Become an environmental engineer. Become an engineer that works with wind or solar or wave power. Look at careers that would help the environment and move toward that direction. Because I think a whole generation can change some of the things we've been doing. But we have to think globally, and we have to reach out globally, because the United States can do these things. It can be meaningful, but less industrialized countries can still have a huge impact, and continuing to discuss those global issues is important, and having students know that them reaching out globally is also important, and not just... small ways too, like recycling and other things are super important, but we need to have those people who can think globally and learn other languages, learn other people's cultures, be willing to do those types of outreach efforts so that people in other countries understand that they also need to work toward these agreements about the world in general. We all have one planet, mm-hmm. and it's our only planet. mm-hmm. So it's really important to think globally.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have that problem. Like, we think about our park a lot, but I think one thing that I really am proud of our staff here is we think about our entire Seward Peninsula in Alaska a lot, too. Like, I mean, sometimes we don't totally go beyond Alaska, but we just don't think of our park as some island that we're influencing. So I really think that's important. And then through Katie's education efforts, through getting distance education going, that helps think globally and more about education to students. Our web presence is extremely important because that's global, and ensuring that is up to date and it has the messages that we want on it is significantly important. I think in those ways, I think we can make a difference. If we didn't think that, we wouldn't be doing what we do. But it would behoove the United States, I would say, to think globally about these issues.
Mm-hmm. That was my big question.
That was your big question.
That got me to thinking about, though, like, yeah, just how, for me, it's become really, like, I've really started to think about my own daily actions and, like, how I can best, you know, make those decisions that are going to, you know, like, reach beyond, if possible.
You the know, park does reach beyond here. Like, we try to buy sustainable products mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. things like that. I think a lot about, like, putting solar at the bunkhouse and how do we engineer yeah. that? How do we work with the city of Nome so we can use some of that power? Where would we put a battery back bank? Having an engineer involved and putting a project together for that, you know, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, that would be another way to, you know, to reduce that footprint.
Just kind of thinking about how every action is significant, you know. It's
So your education program here, just because that's what this fits into, is it, you were saying it's both local and in the various schools here,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and then for visitor, when visitors come to visit Nome, especially in the cruise ships. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because that's also a way of educating not just people here, but people coming in as to what's actually happening in the environment, the Seward Peninsula and in this part of Alaska.
Yeah, we talk a lot about that, right? Because mm-hmm. the cruise ships are coming because of climate change. And having those, many are extremely well-to-do folks understand why they get to take this cruise now is really important.
When did the mm-hmm. cruise ship start docking? Was it last year or the year before?
Oh, it's been a number of years.
Oh, has it?
But it has increased in numbers, I would say. So this summer we have currently on the schedule, from what I've seen, there should be about 11 cruise ships visiting Nome, which in the past it's been
four or five.
And or so.
In the past, it was like one.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really small, more like yacht. Mm-hmm. Things with really lower cruisers, like 100 people on that boat or 75 people on a boat. But now they're bigger. Some of them are bigger boats, and there's more of them.
Like 100, couple of hundred?
200-300 or so passengers. Yeah, yeah.
And then we had the 1,500 passenger one mm-hmm. a couple of years ago.
So this is a great opportunity to educate those people and have a take-home message.
We're told that they get that education, but I think it's important that we continue to do that. But one of the things that's impeding us a little bit is a lot of these are foreign travelers. And while Katie and Lupe are very great at Spanish, we don't have interpreters that speak
primarily French and German.
Yeah. And we used to get quite a few Korean tours too. So that level of how do we interpret that and figure out how to do that when we don't have a language interpreter. And a lot of our materials are written in English, but we have some Russian, but the Russian folks aren't cruising around, at least not in our waters. How are we going to adapt to those different types of languages is another thing that we keep talking about. How do we do that?
Mm-hmm.
And for our small park, it's about applying for project money and getting a project, a grant, or to help us convert some of those materials. And then what do we convert? What do we make for them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, stuff like that. We have to go through the discussions.
Yeah, I think in the next couple of years, because it is a very present and growing opportunity, so the next couple of years it'll be...
And if we have the data to prove that we're going to get, like, French cruise ships, and they're mostly French or mostly German, then we would put announcements out for German-speaking interpreters in the future, or French-speaking interpreters, or if it changes demographics to Korean or whatever, having that upfront knowledge of what type of, where are these people coming from and what language do they primarily speak would be good for us.
Or an international volunteer.
Lots of different ways.
But it's just such a great opportunity from people who have not ever visited this type of an environment to really show firsthand how fast things are changing and how much adaptation is going to be required. Like, it's such a great home global message to these people.
We have to do it in a good way too, though, so they don't feel guilty about their cruise.
Right?
Because studies have shown certain boats do also contribute to climate change. So,
Is there concern with these cruise ships coming up about any type of environmental disaster that could have
from
them? So how are discussions?
Well, not just them, but
the larger ships
and other ships. Yeah. There is a Bering Sea Coalition, and they work to try to get, and they have, things like vessel traffic monitoring, engaging with the Coast Guard, working on plans for environmental hazard mitigation and things like that. There is, the Coast Guard has started doing Arctic drills, because if you get a cruise ship sink with even just 200 people. I mean, 200 people is larger than the village of Wales, right? So all of that plus any spillage of fuels, or there needs to be, and I think they've worked really well on laws in place for discharge of waste. Although I did just read an article about Glacial Bay National Park and Carnival Cruise Lines, I think it was, and they found out that they had discharged and were non-compliant with the discharge of waste on their cruise ships. So, and then you could put those all in the place, but who's going to check and monitor it in such an Arctic region where the Coast Guard is in Kodiak? So there needs to be, the planning is coming along, but I do think that the Coast Guard needs a station in the Arctic. I guess you could consider Kodiak in the Arctic because it's in Alaska, but in that tight little Bering Strait, that is where accidents could occur. So I think that that, and the Russians, and to monitor the Russian and international traffic is important too, because we hear of large fuel vessels, and the Russians have created a brand new nuclear water power plant that is on the water, I guess. And the Chinese are following suit. So there's stuff that's going on internationally that needs to be looked at when you're considering environmental impact. Because we are so close to Russia that if they get a major spill, we're going to get it too. Yeah. And
I mean, if that happened, how would the city of Nome cope? I mean, there's nothing here for that.
No, there's some measures, but they're for smaller spills. I mean, we talk a lot about more boats coming into Nome and how the small discharge, the incidental discharge of fuels through small accidents can accumulate even in the harbor or even right outside of the Snake River. And who's monitoring that and who's ensuring that environment is mitigated in that area? Because the Snake River is a place where people fish and salmon fish and do subsistence activities also. So there's a lot of worry and discussion about that.
Right. So another challenge for the future.
Yeah, and people are by and large I think are working through as many channels as they can to get these issues discussed. I think the Arctic's going to be a different place in the future, and I think we need to do some modeling and some predictive planning to adequately ensure a good environment and a safe environment. Even if that environment's changed, we still need to consider many of those things.
Especially, yeah, access to subsistence is high. I mean, that's a huge priority.
It is, yes. So and that would take some predictive modeling, too. And people have looked at what species win and what species will lose. And I think that that's another discussion to openly have with communities. What access do they think they're going to need in the future is important. Because the last thing I think that I would want to do is, because they can't snowmobile, just say, well, boo-hoo to you. You can't get in the park then. Go buy an airplane. That just doesn't happen. You see what I mean? Like, there's got to be a way to have this further discussion, and congressionally or whatever needs to happen, have that broader discussion about access, and also access to allotments. There are private lands within the preserve.
Oh, is there? I did not realize that.
There are many private lands in the preserve, Alaska Native allotments. And they are suffering because they're coastal from erosion. So what happens when someone's allotment can no longer support their little cabin because it's eroded? Do we just say, oh, too bad for you? You don't get to go camp over there anymore. I mean, there needs to be these discussions about if this is something that they can't control. They didn't lose their allotment because they did something, because it eroded. How do we help them to still utilize the land? And a lot of people go to their campsites. And if those are being impacted by climate change, I think the Park Service needs to look and discuss those issues.
So whether changing the reallotments to somewhere else within the park, those are huge Washington discussions, aren't they?
They are. And a lot of times people think a park manager can make those decisions, but we can only follow the laws that are currently in place for us and then advocate for different things. At least that's how I feel like. Mm-hmm.
How many allotments are in the park? Is there a clear number?
There's a lot. I've never sat and counted them, actually.
Like hundreds?
At least hundreds.
Really?
100. At least. Maybe there may not be a cabin on those allotments or a structure, but people use them. They might tent camp there, or they might just go there to picnic or hang out or do subsistence activities overnight. I mean, I've never counted. That is something I... Hmm. I mean, they mostly occur on the coast.
Of course.
Yeah.
And that's where people would have wanted their allotments, because mm-hmm.
It's where their subsistence activities are happening.
Right.
And it's just beautiful, too. I mean...
When were they allotted, back in the 1970s and 60s, or when did those allotments get...
I think they were during, I want to say, INCSA.
INCSA?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So but they're trust there. Land through the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
And so they've been there for several decades.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yep, yep. And under ANILCA, those are considered private property.
Right.
So to access to allotments is an important part of ANILCA.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I did not know that.
And when you had good coastal areas, access is easy, right? But as access changes, how do we provide that access without damaging the environment?
And the cultural and mm-hmm. natural resources that are there that we discussed yesterday.
Yeah. It's going to be a challenge, definitely. And the Park Service has done some modeling and also climate change planning, and we did that about 10 years ago, but it's time to relook at that plan, because I think that even in 10 years it's changed.
Yeah, from what you've said, yeah, it's the change has been so rapid that 10 years, although 10 years isn't long, it's actually quite long for some of these, especially erosion changes.
Yes. Yes, and the good thing is we have these erosion maps that are coming out, so people can look at them. And that would be a great update is to our climate change scenario planning with local people. It's take the maps out, show them where land is building and where land is receding, then have them discuss through the scenario planning what changes they see, are seeing, and what they think they're going to see in 20 years, and see what they would like to see out of the Park Service mm-hmm. in regard to their private allotments, but also the land that they depend on that's a preserve.
So when these issues come up, and like you said, you're superintendent, you can't do anything, how do you lobby for this, or what do you have to go through to make others hear these issues?
We talk... to our regional office a lot. And a lot of the regional office employees are on larger national committee groups or even work through global organizations. So they go back and they talk about policy. It just takes a while to get policy and regulation changes. Mm-hmm. So I think people are doing what they can, and it's going to take a while. But I am reasonably sure that those kind of things will be addressed.
You feel that you're listened to when you bring these issues
but
to
I
regional?
But I also think that our local Alaska Native groups do it. And if anything, they're listened to by our congressional delegation at a very high level. Me as a government employee, I can't walk into Lisa Murkowski's office and tell her what I think, you know. I don't think I can anyway. But, Melanie Banky can, as the president of COERIC, can set up an appointment and provides this information to her through Austin and everybody else. And they provide recommendation. And I think that those types of interactions happen regularly with the congressional delegation. And I think that they do hear a lot of those groups. Mm.
So their voices are being heard.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like they get heard better through those types of groups than me as a government employee.
But perhaps once the Park Service has done some sort of a study, then it just corroborates mm-hmm. what people mm-hmm. are saying with mm-hmm. scientific data, right?
Yep. Yeah. And I'm not the type that wants to corroborate what people say with scientific data. Mm-hmm. I see what they say as the truth. I'm not the type of person that's like, we must go prove what they say. I just think they should be treated equally. Mm-hmm. And it's all good information. It's all relevant. It's just some people are like, oh, they say this, but is it true? We should go prove it. And I'm like, we don't need to prove it. It's true. They're not making these things up. You know, but there's a lot of people who are like, show me the data. And I'm like, well, I could take you to Shishmaref, and you could see what they see, and we wouldn't need to spend thousands of dollars on data, right? So I'm a little bit different when it comes to people's knowledge, because I don't think people need to be proven. I believe them. And I don't think we need to spend the money on proving what they say is true.
I agree with you. It's just as it goes up further up the chain.
They want it. Yes. But I think that they should spend more time interacting with the people that are facing these issues. And a trip to a village and out into the preserve costs a lot less than thousands and thousands and thousands of dollar studies, or the time it takes, in my mind, to have a paper published and written about it. I mean, I think we have to have that too. Don't get me wrong. We have to have that too. But with the faster way, and also to get more data, is to have people go see it for themselves. Because until you do, the impact is not as significant, I think.
So have you been successful in bringing people up and showing?
The villages have. The villages and the Native Corporation have. I think by and large the National Park Service knows. I mean, we talk about it a lot. There's no convincing. We don't need to convince National Park Service scientists or others in the service. It's the work, I believe, that the Native organizations, the tribes, the Native corporations are doing with their congressional delegations, with their state legislators, to bring these issues to the forefront, and the communities themselves, especially with erosion. Yeah, so I think to get stuff done, we have to involve them, and because they have a really good door to those folks that can make changes. And then how do we do that while also working with the oil and gas industry is always a struggle in Alaska, right? So, yeah.
Is there anything at all, Jeanette, that you would like to talk about that we haven't addressed in this?
No, I guess my big thing for everybody is I really want, I know these impacts are happening locally, but we need to reach out globally and get the message across to many different people to affect change in the climate, and be open to other and different suggestions for energy, access. I think that's really important.
Great take-home message.
I worry about our future generations and what we're leaving them. Yeah, and I feel like some people who have the power to make big change aren't worrying as much.
And why do you think that is? It's not that they're not aware. Is it that they're not aware or that they don't believe?
I don't know. I think it's a combination of a lot of disbelief or unaware. And some people, there are some people that only think about their time here on our planet and don't have the foresight to think about future generations, or people that they don't care, or they think their one little thing won't do something bad, or perhaps what we're doing to the environment is completely natural, part of the worldview, and it's all going to be fine. or something. I have no idea why people would choose to not care. I think people have their thoughts, but I don't see why they wouldn't care.
Katie, did you have any other questions at all that or queries?
Just a final, I was just thinking of a little fun question of what is your favorite part of being superintendent of Barry Lambridge National Preserve?
My favorite part?
I think if you could choose one.
I think it's being able to live and work in the town that I grew up in. Mm-hmm. And help, hopefully help shape an area for which my children will choose to live. I really think about that, and their children's children, and that they could do the things that I got to do, and they could, have the opportunities I have. I really like that I am somehow working toward that goal of ensuring that people's lives, this place can be the way it was or the way it is, you know.
And how do you do that with your children?
Oh, I give them, we go out in the country. I live out in the country, you know. We just do fun activities. Berry picking, green picking, fishing, hunting, snowmobiling, boating, all that stuff. You know, get them out, have fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah, things like that.
And you did say that your son was 21, so is he still here in town?
Yeah, he's here. He's here, and he plans to stay here, so it's really nice. And then my daughter plans to come back, and she's in college in Anchorage. So.
And what is she studying? What does she hope to do?
Her major currently, although she's a freshman, it might change, is international studies. Hmm. And one of her things was to come back and help Alaska deal internationally with international commerce and other situations. So it's kind of cool. She wants to learn about other countries so that she can work in a field where she can help our state better internationally work with others. Right. I hope she still does that. You never know. She's only a freshman, so you know how people's majors change? So right now it's like that, but she could end up doing something completely different by her senior year.
But so
or decide she's going to go do something else. You never know.
But so far, your children are being here.
And two younger kids, too. So, yeah, so far, yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's really nice. Yeah. The opportunities in Nome are really, I think they're really good. And it's a wonderful place to live, I think. And I just don't want it to change so drastically that, I mean, change is inevitable, but I want them to be able to have a wonderful life here, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Jeanette, I know you're such a busy woman. I want to thank you so much for 2 hours of your time for this. It's been absolutely wonderful.
Oh, you're welcome. It's good.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Katie.
Thank you. No, and I was the other thing I was thinking, I was like, I'm very thankful to be guided by Jeanette, your leadership. It's just wonderful.
I love working with everybody here.
Awesome. I think everybody is very fortunate, Jeanette, that you are here.
And I'm fortunate that my staff's so great. I think Dylan just texted. He went pike fishing, and he said, the pike smells kind of funny. I don't know if it's still good.
Oh!
So I told him, I can smell it. I told him to bring it. I'll smell it and
smell
see.
It and see if it's okay. Yeah. Well, thank you again, Jeanette. I'm going to close now. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome.